7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, Todd. How are you today?
Not bad at all.
We have a special guest today, and why don't you go ahead and introduce him?
Well, for those of you who are regular viewers of the show, you've seen Mr. Mike Borfitz before, and we're going to see him again for another round of him sharing his expertise with us. He's the CEO of Kilroy Aviation, has been involved in eVTOL since 2016, which is going to be our subject today, and he's been a safety certification engineer since 1980 for both Boeing and the FAA. You know your way around that system, and when it comes to eVTOLs, which recently in the news, there were some test flights in the New York City area by one of the manufacturers where they're touting this as an alternative for short-term, short-distance air transportation. The test was between JFK and downtown Manhattan, but this is something that the manufacturers of these devices hope to expand around the world. The general subject is called advanced air mobility, and eVTOLs are basically, think of it as a giant quadcopter drone, except there are people inside, including possibly you as a passenger. So, Mike, what can you tell us about the latest iterations of these, and what are the milestones that you've been directly a part of?
Yeah, thanks, Todd. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation. Hi, John. Been a while. Good to see you again. Yeah, I think it's been kind of an interesting evolution of this industry. I think you know, a lot of folks are saying it's probably going to go down, but it's not. There's too much money being going into it. I got involved initially with the first autonomous public flight, which happened in Dubai in September of 2017. I think I've been working with them since late the previous year. And I've been working with Joby, doing a little bit involved with Archer, Ehang, which is a Chinese outfit that actually has a certificated autonomous aircraft that gives tours. And I did some work with Dubai, and also just came pretty close to doing some work with Saudi Arabia. We're also working with an Israeli company that actually has a not an eVTOL, but a fixed-wing aircraft that's in work right now.
So, Mike, where's the money coming from?
Well, a lot of money is coming from the big outfits. I mean, Mitsubishi Heavy Industry, Daimler, Ford, GM, all kinds of outfits. Intel is also pouring some money into this thing. Historically, you know, a lot of startups going way back in history have been have failed, even though they may have had a pretty good product, because of lack of funding. In this case, money is politics. With this much money being poured into the industry, I think it's got to happen, because, again, money is politics. It will happen. It's got to. Some challenges exist, but we're moving forward. No doubt about it.
Now, let me add for the audience that you are the co-chair of an AIAA, that's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, a study group talking about the challenges to the commercialization of advanced air mobility, excuse me. And we'll be having this document on the website that supports the show if you would like to download it and read it yourself. And this is something I, again, came out in January 2025. What are the key challenges, technological and non-technical, with commercializing this? Because, as we all know, there are a lot of technologies out there. Will they click? Will they stick?
Well, that's kind of a big question. The challenges are multifold. They're just everywhere. I think the technical challenges are one thing is the is energy density of batteries. Batteries are not advancing quickly enough that you can actually get much more than maybe half an hour, 45 minutes commercially if you fly with reserves, which is driving a lot of manufacturers to go hybrid. There are a couple outfits that have VTOL aircraft. It also have a little bit of a fuel tank with various types of internal combustion engines to generate power. Politics matters. We have in some cases, oh geez, cities, counties, states that are stepping in and trying to regulate the use of these things, especially in town and the urban environment, because they're all fearful of the whole thing. They're talking about things like clearance from buildings, from tall buildings, and so on, and that. City, states, and counties actually back in the 1920s tried to do exactly that with aircraft. And it turns out that if you were to fly from one state to the next, that you'd have to actually have a different license and a different aircraft registration and so on. Federal government finally stepped in to correct that at the request of industry. And we're not far from that right now. Also, these aircraft in the city, again, are going to be, they're going to be flying around like it's going to be like a cloud of gnats almost in the future, delivering tennis, sneakers, and delivering packages and moving cargo, small amounts of cargo back and forth. And to get these things to fly in an integrated manner and not get chaotic, there's a significant challenge there. We're talking this AIAA committee that I co-chaired. We have we talked about having a mainframe on the ground talking back and forth with each and every aircraft and helping them get to where they need to be. Some folks, I think the FAA for a while was kind of stuck on sense and avoid, but if you have something that's 100 pounds, sense and avoid just isn't going to work because it's just too darn expensive to actually make it work. Not only that, but if you have, I have a mental experiment that I do. If you have a circle with, say, a dozen aircraft, and they have to go to various locations inside that circle, and you let them go all at once, sense and avoid is going to be very, very chaotic. But if you have a mainframe that's telling each one where to go, the separation is going to be much, much better. It's going to be almost instant, and it's going to be very, very effective. That's addressed directly also in the report. Again, politics is a bit of an issue. The regulatory environment is a bit of an issue. All the authorities globally are actually well, they're competing in a sense. And right now, the UAE, Emirates authority, the GCAA, they have Archer and Joby working right now. Joby's flying in Dubai, and Archer's flying in Abu Dhabi, and they're getting ready for commercial operations there. Not only that, but commercial operations have already started in China with EHang. I have a little bit of history with EHang. I actually visited their facility in China back in it was late 2016, I think it was. And they flew two aircraft in Dubai, and I have never said this publicly, but they crashed both of them within about 20 flight hours. I saw one of the wreckages myself. And what happened was EHang was making small drones at the time, for commercial purposes and for toys and so on. And basically, made the aircraft bigger. They just got the toys. They just made them bigger and added a few rotors and motors here and there. And it turns out that there was an upset. One was flying along, and there was an upset, and it couldn't compensate for the upset, and it went in. So they reprogrammed it a little bit, and there was another bit of an upset, and it went in. So that was eye-opening for a lot of people, especially the folks in the UAE. So Joby and Archer are working there right now. They're going toe to toe, and that's going to be really interesting to watch. And Todd, you mentioned JFK to Manhattan in about 10 minutes, as opposed to geez, anywhere from 60 to 90 minutes, and that's a big deal. That's a startling difference, and I think a lot of people are going to be willing to pay for that. So it will happen. And we'll get into this a little bit later, I think. But the industry right now is following all the earlier mass transportation industries that have existed for the last couple hundred years, you know, trains and then planes, and then commercial space is a bit of an issue. It's having some berthing problems, the same as trains and planes. And the eVTOL industry is going through the same thing in a little bit.
One of the unique differences between those transportation options you mentioned earlier is that it'll be everywhere. Rockets, of course, can only launch at various launch points, and trains, once you get through the politics of where you're going to lay down the tracks, it's not going to move anywhere. But you can have a change of where these things fly based on commercial pressures. And hate to bring in this because we're not even at the point where we have thousands of these commercial drones flying, both cargo and passenger. But what kind of pushback would you expect to see if instead of going between an airport and, I don't know, a place with a high density of billionaires like Wall Street, they're going from Dubuque to Iowa City, past neighborhoods, over near schools, and folks being upset saying, look, you know, I don't mind this happening in New York. It's happening over my town, and what if this thing crashes on my kid's school?
Well, let's talk about the perceptions of safety. You know, I think these folks are going to see these things flying overhead, but for the most part, except when they're in transition, basically taking off and getting into cruise and returning to, you know, to the ground safely, that is, at the destination, they're just going to be flying through the air, and that's all they're going to see. You know, so I think that's really not that big a problem. I do believe the perceptions of safety is something that is really got to be dealt with. There's absolutely no doubt about it. You know, as far as the real safety is concerned, back in my Boeing days, there was a study regarding things falling from airplanes, and they decided the likelihood of someone getting injured is actually pretty low. And the reason is that in the country, when you're looking straight down, there's not really that much to hit. And in the city, when you're looking straight down, you're looking at roofs and cars and streets, only where it's really densely populated, like New York City, where you walk along, there's somebody every 4 feet. But there's a lot of coverage there, a lot of protection for people. Furthermore, when you're looking straight down at an individual, you're only talking about 1.5 square feet. You know, I look at you, you're 6 feet tall. You know, what I look at is 8 or 10 square feet, but looking straight down, it's a very small target that you're looking at. I hate to use the word target, but that's kind of the way they approached it. So the real odds of getting injured are actually pretty small, I think. And there will be accidents. You know, we were talking earlier about Newt Rockne and Wiley Post oh gosh,
Will Rogers.
Will Rogers. Yeah, thank you. And you know, those were both really high profile accidents, and that's going to happen again. We know it's going to happen again. I mean, let's talk about commercial space. I looked up the probability of success in space launches. The probability of success is about 96%, which means 1 in 25 aircraft or rockets are not going to get to their destination. They're not going to all go up in flames. Some are just aren't going to make orbit, or they're just going to wind up missing the position a little bit. But still, if that happened out of say LaGuardia, one out of every 25 flights either went in or didn't make it to its destination, it would be pretty bad. But the public is willing to accept that because, first of all, the people who are going up in commercial space, the public looks at those folks as the rich fools, and they deserve what they get. You know, they're willing to take that sort of a risk. But then again, going back to parallels between locomotives and aircraft and so on. The early adopters are going to be paying a lot of money for it, even though it's not going to be a big deal. They're paying just to go up into a parabolic arc. In fact, so they can be weightless for a couple of minutes. But then it's going to become a little less expensive, and it's going to become a little more common. And then more people are going to be going, even thinking about going up into space or going up in these eVTOLs. And it's going to be perfectly fine. Everything is going to be good until somebody famous is killed, or there's a major accident, like you said, in a city or a town where many people are killed or injured, or something spectacular happens. That's when it really sort of hits the fan in the public consciousness. And it will happen, by the way. It will happen. There's no doubt about it. We all know that. We've been in this business long enough to know it. It's not going to be prevented.
And it won't necessarily happen in the U.S. or Western Europe because aviation is a global enterprise. However, there is a radical difference between countries as to how much transparency and openness there would be if there were an accident and an investigation, and whether or not the public at large would have their fears dealt with by an open process as opposed to, I don't know, countries trying to hide what's going on because they have a commercial interest at hand. I'm not saying that a country like China wouldn't be open when it comes to civil aviation accidents, but I am saying that whenever I look for civil aviation accident reports out of China, it is a difficult process. I'll leave it at that.
You ought to know. Yeah. And you know, let's go back and talk about EHang again. Those two accidents, those two hull losses back in it was probably 2015, 2016 before Dubai took me on. They were kind of hushed up. Even Dubai hushed it up. They didn't make a lot of noise about it. And now EHang actually is flying commercially with type certificated aircraft in China, giving autonomous tours right now. And I think it's going to be a little while before any other manufacturer, any other country will be doing that. So just the odds are, simply because they're first in the fleet, because they're first in the world to be doing this, I would not be surprised if the first accident happens in China, whether they covered up or not. You know, word gets out. We all know that. Word gets out. Sometimes it's just rumors, but sometimes those rumors are sourced pretty reliably. So I'm not going to say, you know, there's no way I'm going to say who's going to be first or what's going to happen, but it will happen. And the certification process, by the way, is grueling. The authorities, some of the authorities are going very, very slowly and cautiously, and some are just stepping up. You know, for example, right back to China, first in the world to type certificate an autonomous aircraft with passengers. And I think it's going to be a little while, maybe even a few years before any other authority does the same.
Hate to bring this up, but I believe Germany was the first in the world to certify airships for transatlantic flights. And how'd that work out? Now, but on a more relevant point, back in 2023, I was at South by Southwest in Austin, and that year was the transportation year. There's all sorts of transportation, electrified vehicles, and advanced air mobility. And I distinctly remember a presentation by one of the companies. I can't remember which one. I'm not going to point fingers. But they were saying, oh, yes, once this technology matures, traveling between your airport and your home will be as expensive as an Uber. And I thought to myself, no, it won't be. Ubers are not driven by people who have certifications from governments who have taken years to get certified. And I know how much it costs to take an Uber. I know how much it costs to fly a Cessna 172, much less sophisticated than these eVTOLs. It's not going to be the same. But so the point is, the expectations that are being generated by the companies that have a vested interest in the success of this, is it going to be something that will engage the public until they get disappointed and therefore have a backlash against this being implemented?
Oh, you know, boy.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
It's a mouthful.
You know, two things come to mind here. The first is what you described basically, Todd, was a parallel to the VLJ days. Now, the dream here was that the VLJs are going to have a pilot flying passengers everywhere from one airport to the next pretty much freely without necessarily having set routes. And what part of what killed that idea was simply that a commercial pilot had to do the flying. And the other part, of course, was the VLJ is not an inexpensive aircraft. You know, the Honda jet, I don't know how much it costs, what, maybe 10 million, 15 million, something like that, to haul just maybe three passengers plus a pilot. And thinking back, I think there was not as much really heavy money coming into that industry to make it happen, which goes back to money as politics. And again, we have this, you know, this with the eVTOL industry. The other is the notion of these aircraft are going to have to be fully integrated systems because we're talking about aircraft that are not just flying with typical aerodynamic principles. They're going to be vertical lift. We talked about this a little bit earlier. And a vertical lift, when an aircraft is going vertically, one of these aircraft, and you lose power, you cannot auto-rotate. You cannot glide to a safe landing. You're going straight down, and that's it. So there have to be special regulations to deal with that. And the software is going to be the boss of this entire thing. So the software has to be really robust, which means that a pilot can almost be a secondary consideration if it's done properly. Is it possible that sometime an operator, an eVTOL operator hauling passengers commercially, can actually have just maybe some sort of a certificate that's less than a commercial pilot, because the aircraft itself is what carries all the reliability and the safety aspects of operation? It's something to think about.
At this point of the development technologically of these human-rated or soon-to-be human-rated systems, is there any, let's say, is it realistic to expect that there will be a transition from having a crewed aircraft to an uncrewed, remotely piloted vehicle or semi-autonomous vehicle hauling passengers?
There has to be. And I'm a bit of an optimist, not necessarily a Pollyanna, but this goes back to what I was just talking about with the fully integrated systems. Eventually, it's going to come to the point where a pilot's going to be unnecessary, you might say, and that's going to scare a lot of people. I got to thinking about elevators, for example. Here's a great example for this whole thing. Elevators initially were, they had operators, they had a little handle, they'd move it up and down, they'd get the floor of the elevator, even with the floor of the building, sometimes a little bit jerkily, but they would, by golly, do it. But folks got accustomed to having an operator. The good operators were just smooth. And in time, elevators become more automated. You know, people were fearful of these things, but they became more automated. And there were also safety factors that were built into the elevators. For example, if the cable snapped, they had brakes that would open automatically if it started to fall more quickly than expected, and it would stop it pretty quickly. But when they started putting buttons in these things, folks were really kind of nervous about not having an operator there. And in some cases, they put an operator there in uniform to push that button and just to make sure that the elevator was going to function properly and safely. So, and you know, I don't know, but it would seem to make sense to me. There might even be a little handle there. It wouldn't do anything, but at least it was there for the perception of safety. And that's just sort of thinking a bit out of the box there. But that is the kind of thing that may have to happen. I mean, going from commercial pilots to somebody who's just certificated as an operator to somebody who's actually just sort of sitting there observing the flight of the aircraft, maybe ready to take over if necessary, until eventually somebody's just going to hop in one of these things and say, take me to you know, McDonald's.
I happen to live in Northern California, and the streets are, I wouldn't say chock-a-block full, but on a regular basis, I see driverless vehicles, Waymo, even once or twice the Tesla version of a driverless vehicle. And yes, they're weaving in and out of traffic with everyone else. They're not doing anything outrageous. I've never seen them do anything that would make me nervous. But the fact when I look over and I see absolutely no one in the car, it makes me a little bit nervous. Now, would I actually take a ride in one of these driverless Uber-type vehicles? Eventually. Am I going to do it this month? Highly unlikely. Next month? Highly unlikely. Next year? Under duress, yes.
And you said it all.
That's how I feel about.
I've ridden in the driverless vehicles in Las Vegas multiple times.
Well, there are things that happen in Vegas that happen nowhere else. And in a state of mind when you visit, it's like, let me try something new and different.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
This is fascinating, this whole thing. You know, we're right smack in the middle of a revolution in transportation. I'm absolutely convinced of it. It's like, well, a little while ago, we were talking about the great shakeout. And I think I want to just expand on that a little bit. We just sort of touched on it earlier. In the early days of aviation, all kinds of crazy aircraft were around, you know, folks just putting wings on their arms and trying to flap, and people falling down hills and doing all kinds of crazy things, crazy pratfalls. And a lot of these aircraft didn't work, but they had funding. They had funding. It's interesting because a lot of them failed. A lot of them failed even though they had good aircraft, because maybe the same concept was being funded by someone else, and not, and somebody with the same type of aircraft wouldn't get funding, so they'd go under. And some required a lot of investment, a lot of work, until finally they got to working. But there were dozens and dozens and dozens of different types of aircraft that were trying to fly and trying to get into the business of aviation. The same thing's happening now. You know, I think there are, I'm sure there's a great deal of startups out there with various sized eVTOLs that aren't going to make it. They're just not going to make it for the same reasons, for the very same reasons. And some of them are going to get swallowed up. You know, the good ones are being swallowed up right now. I can't give you any details, but some outfits that are looking pretty good are being bought out or being merged or whatever. I think, it was Joby merged with somebody not too long ago because they had some pretty good ideas. But it's happening right now. We are in the midst of what I call the great shakeup. And not many are going to come out on top here. Maybe some of the smaller ones delivering sneakers and pizzas inside town. But for the bigger ones, it's going to be, I'm predicting there'll be just a very small number. And from that point forward, the industry is going to grow much more slowly. Right now, it's explosive.
Let me throw a curveball at you. You've been involved in eVTOLs and thinking about it and working with industry groups for years. What you and I and everyone else in the industry did not foresee was a massive, rapid increase in technological sophistication for autonomous and semi-autonomous vehicles in warfare in Ukraine. Is there anything that's happening over there that has relevance to eVTOLs as you've seen?
No, I think one thing when I watch these things is it takes me back to energy density. And that's one thing. The other thing is navigation. But the energy density thing, these drones out there in warfare, they have to go out quite a ways. They have to go behind enemy lines and actually last a little while. They have to hover. They have to lurk and look for a target, back to that word. And that becomes an issue, because if this aircraft can only fly for half an hour, 45 minutes, what good can it do? How can it actually help you in a battle? So that's one issue. And the other issue is just plain navigation. You know, the GPS system is really, really robust. We know that. It can be, I've forgotten the word that's used frequently, but it can be spoofed. So there are issues there. There are security issues. There are cyber issues. There are remote hijacking issues. And those are all possible. And, you know, not only that, but also defensive mechanisms and systems that will bring something down while it's in mid-flight. That can happen. And, you know, directly, you know, related to that also, we had a midair of a firefighting aircraft not too long ago. That's an issue. But in wartime, you know, that just happens. But otherwise, separation is an issue, especially when anybody can get a drone and just send it up as high as that person wants to send it and intentionally get in front of an airplane. So that's a big deal.
I believe this morning, John, you emailed me something about a United aircraft, I believe, flying into San Diego that allegedly got struck by a drone at 3,000 feet. Full disclosure, 400 feet is the limit for most commercial and recreational drones. I don't know who would want to fly something at 3,000 feet, but we have evidence that it happens. And that sort of hazard, big airplanes, small airplanes, I don't think it'll be any more of a hazard for your eVTOLs. But based on what you've seen, would it be more or less of a hazard running into smaller drones? Well, drones, period. Both the ones that are out there now and the commercial ones that will be out there in force in 5 to 10 years.
So the real battle is going to be with who's going to use that 500 feet of airspace. Then all these vehicles are looking to use that close to ground airspace. Helicopters are in that space already, right? Now we have a million recreational drones that are sharing that space with helicopters, and there's been mishaps already with those. And now we're going to add these air mobility vehicles. And of course, they're going to be controlled by air traffic control. So they're probably going to go up higher. But in and around the cities or in and around the factory areas, corporate campuses, where there's a little open space, there could be drones in and around that neighborhood. It's going to be interesting.
Geez, absolutely. So yeah, there's going to be private, there's going to be commercial, there's going to be helicopter. And oddly enough, the helicopters are going to be the less reliable, the less predictable, because there's a human at the controls. That human may just go left, right, forward, who knows what. My sense is that every aircraft eventually is going to have some sort of a transponder with GPS information being sent out right now. And that's, the big airlines have that. We have that. We have those systems that are in place to help with that. But going back to having a mainframe on the ground to essentially do air traffic control in real time, it's going to have to be a supercomputer. We know that because it will be like a cloud of gnats. I said that earlier. And what I foresee is, again, this is just me sort of hypothesizing. I see every aircraft in the air, helicopters, commercial, private drones, et cetera, actually having a GPS transponder, which is going to increase cost for the folks who use these things as for pleasure. And this computer is going to be actually directing these things because it knows where it started and where it needs to go. And I see actually one simple solution would be to put a bubble around a helicopter or an airplane, a manned airplane that's going to be flying through the sky through there, and just have the computer accommodate any unpredictable movements that these manned aircraft might make, so that there's enough of a bubble that it can also make commands as it flies through this cloud of gnats. So I can just see a bubble sort of flying through this little cloud. I think that's one way to approach it, and it's going to take a lot of better brains than I have to make it actually work.
The cost point, price point for these vehicles are so high that outside of extremely wealthy individuals or corporations, it's unlikely to have a market on the consumer level. So we don't have to worry about someone ordering this online and building it in their backyard and flying it for the heck of it. But if it is successful on the commercial end, what's the maximum kind of density could you see happening of these aircraft? Tens of thousands, let's say in the United States, or hundreds?
Hundreds of thousands in the United States. I could see hundreds, I mean hundreds, maybe a few thousand in the air at any one time in the big cities. Because I want a hamburger, right? Boom, boom, dial it in, shows up 10 minutes later. How's it going to get there? It's going to be flown to you by a little 10-pound drone. In the limit, I can see this happening quite a bit. And it's a ways down the road, but I really believe it will happen because the navigation's there, the computer power is there, the aircraft is there. In city, when you only have about a 15 or 20-minute flight, you don't have to worry about energy density. So that's one big deal.
But the other thing that one can't work around is the last mile problem. When I take an Uber from the airport, I get dropped off my front door. If I had to take were to take an eVTOL, I might be within a few blocks of my front door. But at 1 a.m. in the morning, when it's cold and wet outside, do I want to be a few blocks from home or do I want to be at home?
Well, here's the other thing to consider. In say New York or LA or someplace like that that doesn't have a lot of heliports, You got a lot of rooftops, but can you imagine a heliport on the top of each and every roof? That's going to take a little bit of doing. There's where the cities and the zoning and the city councils and all are going to have to play a big role, and there will be resistance for that. So it's going to be an interesting issue.
I have visions of hundreds of lawyers in every municipality on both sides of the issue arguing this until, I don't know, later this century.
Yeah. Yep, there'll be some of that.
And you see a lot of the delivery services talking about putting landing pads on the roofs of buildings. And even the bigger firms like Google and their competitors, Walmart, they're talking about putting landing pads on the top of a Walmart store. So they can get deliveries to the store. Because if the stores are faced with the same problem with traffic and trying to get their goods to the store. I mean, yeah. I got stuck behind a Costco truck yesterday, right, in traffic, and somebody moved the truck in a certain way that the trailer couldn't move. And it took us about 15 minutes until that's cleared. Yeah. So they face with the same problems.
There will be cargo will be hauled in city. It will happen. UPS, I think, experimented a little while ago, may be doing it right now. In sparsely populated areas, they have a van, they have a hole in the roof, and they just have a drone that's going to just take off through the roof and deliver something miles away that saves this van maybe an hour, two, 3 hours just from driving up, you know, through the boonies to deliver a single package. And that's happening right now. So a similar concept could work in city. You could have just this small, almost a kiosk sort of a thing, where packages could be delivered, and it wouldn't necessarily be a full heliport, and it would be to the benefit of all the people living in that particular building. So that could happen. It's not going to be leaps and bounds. It's going to be teeny increments. It's going to be baby steps. But it's going to, you know, frankly, 10, maybe 20 years before it's in full operation, before it's in full bloom, you might say. And, you know, maybe we'll be around by then, maybe not, but I do believe the growth will continue.
So what, and the certification standards, what do you think needs to change to make this happen?
One big thing goes back to integrated systems. The old style of certification, the today style of certification, is a type certificate is issued to an aircraft. That aircraft design is then tossed over the wall into operation. We have two separate organizations in the FAA. Aircraft certification does design and production approvals. Flight standards takes care of maintenance, training, operations, and so on. And in this case, we have these aircraft that are going to be flying ultimately autonomously. Everything has to be integrated. Air traffic has a piece of this thing, because if they're going to have unmanned aircraft, unpiloted aircraft flying through the air, air traffic has to know what's going on. And their job is to control traffic. And in this case, will they be actually directly controlling these aircraft that are flying autonomously? Probably not. When the time comes. So, and the systems, airways facilities could have an issue, because VORs are probably going to go away, because it's going to be all GPS operated. The reliability becomes a factor in both operation and design. So I think, first of all, the regulatory authorities have to work together closely to make these things work in a way that's absolutely brand new to the entire regulatory system. I think that's one issue. And again, as I mentioned earlier, some of these regulatory authorities are stepping up far, far more quickly than others. FAA and EASA, the European authority, they're both going very, very slowly with this thing, but they're also the world leaders, and they are appropriately conservative. But on the other hand, they're taking pressure. They're taking political pressure. The FAA, I've always defined as a technical organization in a political world. And that's a fact, because politics drives itself down into the reality of you know, the technical aspects of operation and certification. So it's going to be, there's a lot of pressure right now, for a fact, inside the FAA, inside my, you know, my old friends back in the FAA are they're getting a lot of pressure to move things forward more quickly. But they also have an obligation to the public to assure safe operations.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so, and we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join, do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like, and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation. Now, I typically have a second-to-last word, but I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to have a second-to-last comment or question, and this is one directed at the future. As you know, John and I just spent several days at the aerospace maintenance competition down at MRO Americas, and we were enthusiastic about it and really impressed by the young people coming up. And my question is to you, to them. You're a hard charger, pilot, mechanic, what have you, and you see this going on. You were smart enough to watch this episode of the podcast. And you're saying to yourself, okay, what's in it for me? If you were to tell somebody who is at the beginning of their career why they should throw their hat in the ring and go all in on some startup company, why should they do so?
Well, first off, to be on the cutting edge of what's going to be normal in not too distant future, there are people who are risk takers, you know, risk with their employment, you know, so maybe they don't want to go take a steady job in an FBO or hang out their own shingle as a mechanic or go to the airlines. So they may want to do something different. We have mechanics at our competition that work for the space shuttle, the X version of them, SpaceX version of the space shuttle. So there's you know, different strokes for different folks. You want to be on the cutting edge of a new emerging mode of transportation? The opportunity's there. Ironically, Todd, you don't even know this, but my granddaughter went into the Air Force. She got married to a B-52 mechanic in the Air Force. He came out several months ago, towards the end of the year. I think it was December he came out. In January, he got hired by a drone manufacturer and has gone to school to maintain the drones. That's what's going on today.
Well, let me add another parallel here, guys. I think not long ago, 10, 20 years ago, a good mechanic had busted knuckles and a really great vocabulary, right? Just from turning wrenches. And now there's a guy right down the street who works in a single garage, and he's all alone. It's a dirty, nasty garage, just like you would expect from something like that. Had a problem with my car. He came out with a little box, plugged it in, found the problem. So that's where the whole thing is going. And not only that, people will have to turn wrenches.
Right. The things are going to break.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I can remember going to Boeing in years ago, 30 years ago, and a discussion was started with a bunch of young guys at Boeing and about reliability. And I don't remember if I said it or somebody else said it about why can't we get more reliability out of the airplanes? One of the comments that came back, how much reliability do you want to buy?
There you go.
There you go, because we can build a widget that's 99.9999% reliable. It might be too heavy, and it might be more expensive than you want to pay.
Yeah, there's a curve there. The curve goes kind of like that. It's kind of linear, and the reliability and efficiency goes up with cost. But then all of a sudden, there's a knee where it goes like that again. It just goes up far more steeply. You're getting far less per dollar. And the knee of the curve is where most folks want to be. Right. So that's a great comment. I love it.
Right. You can have all the right reliability you want. It's just going to cost you.
And as is our tradition, we now give it to you, John, for the last word.
Well, since this is a manned flight program, I will do what I always say. If you're going to go flying, you need to plan it. Even drones need to be planned. So we need to plan your flight. Both here, there, and everywhere in between, including the weather. You need to also do a very good, concise job of pre-flighting your airplane. And after you're done and you get in the air, I just read today, this morning, that there's 887,000 pilots now in the United States. And hundreds of thousands of those are flying on student pilot licenses. So it's pretty hard to get away from the student pilot area around general aviation airports. And therein lies the problem. Newbies in the air, trying to build their time and build their experience. And if you're all going out there flying, put that head on a swivel. But we're getting so many near misses and almost every day when I raise the question at my local FBO, somebody else is telling me of one that happened, you know, the other day. So please, please pay attention when you get up in the air. And please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing Program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.